back in the day, RSS was the thing. You'd sign up to sites and get their RSS feed. And then we came along and said, no, it's going to be better when we let algorithms choose your content. Oops. Right? Because who knew the algorithms were going to be all about engagement that itself would lead to rage baiting? I mean, talk about metrics driving behavior, right? Whoever picked the metrics that we picked, right? Reposting, liking, engagement, replies as the measure of quality or the thing that you're going to pay for, that drove us to where we are with all the clickbaiting and rage baiting and blah, blah, blah. So literally, I kind of, there are nights when I wish for RSS to be back, you know, but hey, I'll just let me sign up for certain publications and I'll see the feed. I don't need the algorithm. Thanks.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. Welcome back to AI and the Future of Work. We recently welcomed our 1 millionth listener to this community. Thanks, as always, for making this one of the most downloaded podcasts about the future of work. I'm your host, Dan Turchin, CEO of PeopleRain, the AI platform for IT and HR employee service. And today's episode is one of my favorites all year. It's the one where we throw all the structure and prep out the window while we drink from the font of knowledge named Dave Kellogg. No AI fun fact today, and no preamble means more time for witty banter. Dave needs no introduction, but you know what? I'll introduce him anyway. Dave's a serial CMO and CEO at companies like Host Analytics, Salesforce, MarkLogic. We opened the Wayback Machine, Business Objects. He's now a venture capitalist at Balderton Capital. Dave's the author of the popular Kell blog and is perhaps most recognized as the guy who challenges everything you thought you knew about SaaS and growth metrics. Dave's annual predictions are the stuff of legends. He's a perennial favorite on this podcast where we give him an audience to share his bold, non-obvious, and often controversial predictions. This year's treatise spans 10 wide-ranging predictions across 6,000 words. And of course, we will link to the full post in today's show notes. Without further ado, Dave, my friend, welcome back to the podcast. Why don't you catch our audience up by sharing a bit more about what you've been up to?
Sure. Well, thanks, Dan. It's great to see you again. Congrats on all the success with the podcast. Last 12 months, what I've been doing. You know, I work with Balderton Capital, so I'm an EIR there, and I advise portfolio companies. They're based in London, so I do a lot of work with European startups. I sit on a few boards also in Europe, and I do equity-based advising, kind of classical Silicon Valley advising for about a dozen startups. And I write the blog, started a podcast, so SaaS Talk with the Metrics Brothers. So, you know, it's been a busy year.
Dave, most prognosticators don't judge themselves. You're an anomaly. A good chunk of the 6,000 words are devoted to an assessment of 2023. So maybe just share a summary of how you did last year.
Yeah, so I think I did pretty well. It's self-graded, and I must admit to being a gentle scorer on some of them. I think it's important, you know, I can't remember where, but one time I was talking to a business school professor, and the answer was, if you want to get better at anything, measure it, right? And that includes decision-making. And in general, people are rotten about measuring decisions. Like, I once proposed at one of the companies I worked at that we kind of write down the voting on decisions and review it a year later. Like, who voted in favor of this acquisition? Who voted in favor of this reorg? And the enthusiasm for that around the table was like zero, right? Nobody wants to be held accountable for that. It's damn shame, really. You only get better at something by trying to see how you did. So this year, it was pretty good. I don't think I make super high risk predictions. So a lot of my stuff, I think, are either a desire to manifest things. Like, I wanted a certain book, The Crux to Become Strategy Book of the Year, that was manifesting, kind of a hit. And some of them are extrapolation, you know, and also cycles. I like to watch cycles in Silicon Valley. One of the nice things about being older is you could say, gosh, I remember the 90s when you would go to Bucks and people would talk about founder issues, and like, founders were evil in the early 90s. And then I remember that, you know, after Andreessen Horowitz got formed, then founders became like super cool and had the Harry Potter invisibility cloak and could kind of do anything and never get fired, right? And then you watch it swing back. So I like to watch the cycles of Silicon Valley. So a lot of my predictions are also about cycles.
One of the things that you talked about a lot in your 2023 predictions is the impact of the post zero interest rate policy era on startups and the venture ecosystem. And before we can even get into 2024, I want the audience to learn from you. Do you feel like you underestimated, overestimated, or were you about right in terms of what you thought would happen in the venture ecosystem?
I think I was right in all respects but one, which is I was right about what I called the great pendulum and the master pendulum, that to me there's this giant pendulum on Sand Hill Road that goes back and forth, and it drives other pendulums. Like when we have free money, then everyone's hiring, so employees get an enormous amount of power, and we get all the perks and all the RSUs and the ping pong tables and the company offsites and, you know, all that culture, quote unquote, which I never think of it as culture. I think of it as perks. I think culture is something different. But all that is driven by the funding pendulum, right? Valuation is driven by the funding pendulum. Valuation is driven by the funding pendulum. And when that swings back, employees get less power, right? So, you know, get back in the office and we're getting rid of the ping pong tables. When that pendulum swings back, People care more about profit than growth, right? Because valuations come down, and all of a sudden, money costs dilutions. Structure comes back, right? Like when valuations are high, you don't tend to see a lot of structure. When valuations are low, and you're trying to raise money, maybe you do a 1.5x liquidation preference on the most recent round, right? So all these things are kind of driven by a pendulum, and I think I called the pendulum correctly. The only thing I think I got wrong was I thought there'd be more PE acquisitions. And I think I was maybe off by a year on that.
One of the comments you make in the 2024 predictions is that retention is the new growth. And I can tell you, Dave, as a CEO of a venture-backed company, it sure doesn't feel that way. What's your sense? Is the mood still shifting, or is that that's a bold prediction?
So for 2023, yeah, the retain is the new ad. Look, I think that one was right. I think customer success got a lot of focus in 2023, that, hey, wait a minute. And by the way, expansion ARR as a percent of total ARR went from order of magnitude 30 to order of magnitude 50, depending on what benchmark you're looking at, right? So people definitely pulled more money from their customers than, and that was really the intent of the prediction. I think a lot of people misread the prediction. And there's a sentence in there that I wrote that while this bodes well for the CS discipline, it does not automatically bode well for the CS department. And I think some people saw that sentence and some people didn't, because the good news is you're in the spotlight. The bad news is you're in the spotlight. And some companies reacted to that by kind of slutmaning their CS department, i.e. blowing it up and saying, no, sales should do this. And some people reacted to it by actually putting more focus and investing more in CS. So I do think that retain was very much the new ad, and the metric I'd use is expansion ARR as a percent of new ARR.
Frank, if you're listening, join us on the podcast. I want you to defend your controversial take on the role of CSM. Dave, let's move into 2024. And gosh, this is a hard conversation because any of your 10 predictions is worthy of its own episode. And we're going to try to squeeze thoughts on a few of these into one measly episode. Prediction one, you term election dejection. So I've talked on this show about what I think we're entering a post-truth era where everything that you see, everything that shows up in your feed, you have to question. And perhaps there's a, you know, you can play the positive side of that and say, well, maybe we should always have questioned, you know, our source and, you know, authenticity and things like that. But more than ever, you know, 2024, half of the world's population is going to go to a polling place. You know, here we are when synthetically generated content is, you know, easier to deceive populations than ever before. What's the impact of AI going to have on certainly elections, but more broadly, you know, on what it means to believe in the output of media?
Yeah, so this is a big one. It hits on actually several predictions of the post, I'd argue. Just remember back in 2000 how excited we all were when the internet was happening, right? That, wow, content wants to be free and there's going to be high quality content everywhere, right? And then we've watched the internet kind of turn into a garbage dump. And it was like, long live PageRank. It's going to save us from keyword gaming, playing TF-IDF games, right? We're all super excited. And literally that entire cycle has gone full circle, right? Google, the guys who became billionaires by hating ads are now laden with ads on the website, right? They're front-running content providers with snippets, and people also ask. I mean, it's literally like a black and white change. It happened over 20 years, so it's kind of a boiled frog. Like, you don't notice it. But if you just step back and go, what were we thinking in 1998 about the internet, and what do we think now, right? And it's really become kind of a wasteland. And by the way, you know, other just fun notes. Back in the day, RSS was the thing. You'd sign up to sites and get their RSS feed. And then we came along and said, no, it's going to be better when we let algorithms choose your content. Oops. Right? Because who knew the algorithms were going to be all about engagement that itself would lead to rage baiting? I mean, talk about metrics driving behavior, right? Whoever picked the metrics that we picked, right? Reposting, liking, engagement, replies as the measure of quality or the thing that you're going to pay for, that drove us to where we are with all the clickbaiting and rage baiting and blah, blah, blah. So literally, there are nights when I wish for RSS to be back, you know, but hey, I'll just let me sign up for certain publications and I'll see the feed. I don't need the algorithm. Thanks. Last thing I'd say is you're right. We're on the cusp of making this all way worse. Like SEO is already completely bombed out. And now we're going to be able to generate 100 times more cruft to jam up the machine. So I think AI is going to look, I think search on AI is interesting. On the one hand, it's going to ruin classical SEO by just like 100x more cruft for the machine. On the other hand, generated answers are going to try and cut through that cruft, which in turn is going to beg the question. You know, I feel like generated answers are a little bit more winner takes all than list of links, right? Because list of links, oh, darn, I'm number 7, not number 3. But if I ask ChatGPT for 5 tools I should evaluate for my shortlist, you're either on it or you're not, right? There's no consolation prize. So I think there's going to be huge changes across search, content, and the internet.
At least with a list of links, Google labels what's sponsored, and there's a reference, there's a link to the underlying content. Unlike Gen AI, which is just credible nonsense. What does that mean when we can no longer trust the output? And it may or may not be explainable, although hopefully that changes. But our fundamental relationship with the content we consume has to change, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. There's two fun references. I think they're both in the blog. I can't remember. But one is Stephen Wolfram of Wolfram Alpha wrote a book on how ChatGPT works. And it's the perfect book for someone like me because it's technical enough. Right. But not too technical. So he hit me perfectly in terms of like understanding. And one of his rants is that ChatGPT can't do math. And you could very easily just demonstrate this by asking it questions and it will get the wrong answer because it doesn't know how to do math. And it needs to be, in effect, his argument augmented with something like Wolfram Alpha. So I think that's one effect. I mean, there's two things going on. One is the absence of sources to me leads to actually both of these lead to retrieval augmented generation. Where you are allowed to kind of top up the knowledge base of the model, and it will give you sources. As I mentioned in one of the predictions, I'm a big fan. I can't say I'm an expert in it yet, but I'm a big fan of everything I've heard about retrieval augmented generation because it addresses the two biggest problems I see with Gen AI, which is one, kind of hallucinations and mistakes, and the other is lack of sources. Like, where did this come from? I can't just use this. And no way in the enterprise are you going to use something if you didn't know where it came from?
Maybe just to expand on that, your prediction 7 is from rags to riches. And loyal listeners will know that we've had a lot of the leaders in RAG on this podcast. Arvind Jain from Glean. I think you referenced Glean.
Pitu
Reddy's been on from Abacus AI. Amar Awadalla from Vectara. Great, great discussion. All of whom have really pioneered the introduction of RAG on retrieval augmented generation to augment foundation models. Maybe just say a little bit more at the Stephen Wolfram level of technical detail. Why do you feel like, why was RAG important enough to include in your predictions?
Well, two reasons. One, I was like having fun with all the stuff, Dan, as you know, and there was what I found to be one of the funniest things I read in all of 2024, which was the Chevrolet of Watsonville chat. Because welcome to Chevrolet of Watsonville. How can I assist you in your search? And the guy types
in for a penny.
I mean, Python script to solve the Navier-Stokes fluid flow equations of the zero vorticity boundary. Just fantastic, right? And certainly, here you go. So that was getting topical. People, and literally, I sent that to a friend of mine, and he sent me back a one-word email, and the answer was RAG. They need RAG. So part of it was we had a fun example of what happens when you don't have RAG. So that made it fun to talk about. The other, as you know, is I ran an enterprise search company, right? MarkLogic was an enterprise search company. It was a slightly different approach to search, but I've always had a lot of passion for search and content management as a result. I had a good friend who's a longtime enterprise search person, and he called me up and said, "Enterprise, you're not going to believe this. Enterprise search is cool again." I'm going to say, "No, that's not possible." And he's like, "Yeah, it is. There's this thing called RAG." So it was literally like within a period of 2 weeks, both those things happened. And it got me very quickly and very interested in it.
When you were at MarkLogic, I was at a spin out from Verity called Search Button. So you and I have had fun opening up the enterprise search time capsule. And you're right. What's old is new again.
Yeah. And enterprise search is cool. And I have a lot of, I mean, look, these companies have raised a lot of money. Glean has raised over $150 million. Cohere has raised $400 million. And they're trying to apply this stuff to enterprise, which I think is, you know, we're both old enterprise veterans. I mean, I think enterprise is different than consumer internet, and it has different requirements. And frankly, RAG is perfect for the two things that enterprise wants, which is sourcing and basically the absence of hallucinations and mistakes. And I can try and figure that out through sourcing as well. So, oh, I know the other one, three, let me just say, is the ability to top up the knowledge base. I have a whole knowledge base full of tech support calls about my company, something you would know a lot about, right? I want to be able to take the foundational model and you know, add this to it. Please let me do that.
Prediction four is certainly the basis of a whole series of episodes. AI climbs the hype cycle. And maybe I'm going to tease out a few themes in here. Again, 6,000 words. There are a lot of themes. But specifically, very soon, Uncle Microsoft funding the world's use of ChatGPT is going to run out. It's a $10 billion investment, and we've all benefited from being able to explore the limits of ChatGPT. One of your themes is pricing is going to change to be able to access some of these services. What do you think is going to happen in the next 12 months?
There's a lot going on there. One, I don't know enough about it, but I've been seeing stuff that these massive investments are often swapped back for computing credits and stuff. So they're not, one of the things Silicon Valley does really well is blur up what kind of money it is, right? Like somebody will do $100 million and 80 will be secondary and 20 will be primary. And that's, if you get that next level of detail, you're like, wait a minute, the company only got 20 million or sometimes 0 million, right? And the existing investors got 80 or 100. Those big eye-popping deals, we're very good at the headline figures. A lot of them are swapped back for computing credits and GPU credits. So I don't understand those deals well enough. But since you brought them up, I did want to mention it's something we should all look at more carefully. Cut to your real question. How is this going to affect pricing? And there's here we go, back to pendulums, Dan. There's always this pendulum that goes, ooh, there's a new way to price something. So all the VCs get really excited and say, we should price that way. So, you know, we should price by subscription because perpetual, well, that's not good anymore. We need to go subscription. And they say, well, subscription is not good anymore. We should price by usage. Because I remember when I was running Host Analytics, we'd be like, hey, we're saving these people $250,000 a year and we're only charging them $50. Right? My board member would be like, you're not charging enough. And then the sales rep would be like, well, Adaptive Insights is charging them $25. So and that's the other boundary, which is the price of alternatives, right? So there's two boundaries in pricing. The upper bound is how much value is this thing creating? The lower bound is how much I can get it for from somebody else. So yeah, it's a great deal for me to spend $50,000 on Host Analytics to get $250,000, but it's an even better deal to spend $25,000. So, and by the way, in that competitive market situation, and then it becomes about differentiation. It's not even about value. It's like, hey, I can get $250,000 by buying either one of you. Tell me why you're better. Tell me why you're worth twice as much, right? And that was the conversation you have. So that's my philosophy on pricing. Right now, AI is going to drive value-driven pricing, right? You can see it already. People are saying, ooh, let's price for value. We're adding so much value, right? Because you will be, that we should try and capture that directly in the pricing. And the answer to me is, yeah, why not? If you've got a totally unique product and the only person in town selling it, then great. Then you can say, hey, I'm going to save you $250, so I want $200. I don't want $50, right? I mean, I have to make sure there's some return on it for you. but I want to capture more of that value myself. The issue is if there's five other people selling it, and by the way, this is what the last few years have been like. If there's five other people selling it and they're all flooded with capital willing to buy your business because they think there's high switching costs, then you know they're going to be selling it for $30,000. and you're going to have to suck that up. So I think the thing I'm sure about is AI is definitely putting pressure on value-driven pricing. And the question is, who's going to be able to actually do it and who's going to be able to get that money? It's a great idea, but will the market let you do it?
So a related theme that hangs off of just the broader topic of LLM pricing is, what's the impact on pricing if the owners of the foundation models, open or closed source, need to license content, like, say, from the New York Times? That could easily add a zero, maybe two zeros, to the cost to develop and take these models to market. What happens in 2024 in terms of the impact on what we pay as consumers or the impact on what enterprises pay? And how does this all get litigated from the perspective of the courts and organizations like OpenAI?
Yeah, I think this is an open question. I must admit, I have a little bit of a bias because I am a content producer at small scale, right? But I have 700 posts on Kelblog. They're probably between 4 and 10 hours each. So somewhere between 3,000 and 7,000 hours of work into my own little site. And there are people, by the way, there are people who've built wrapper models that are basically Dave Kellogg in a box. Some guy built one that was just my site. Someone took 20 SaaS experts and built a combined SaaS expert site, right? So in reality, and I'm not being paid for any of that, and I'm not upset about that right now, but if all of a sudden someone's charging, $1,000 a year for access to a virtual me, and I'm a huge part of the content, I'm going to have an issue with that. And so I do have a bit of a bias coming into this. Like, I do think content owners create value. And if you want to train your stuff on my content, I should share some of that value. Now, my son, Alex, we were literally just debating this last night. He thinks he's the next generation, right? So he's like, no, that's going to go away. That issue's resolved. And I'm like, no, the New York Times, their content was literally being regurgitated straight up by ChatGPT. And it's like, they fixed that overnight. This is not going to be an issue. So even in our own household, he was visiting, we have this debate about how that's going to play out. In general, the content producers don't do well, in my mind. The courts seem to interpret fair use pretty broadly. Now, the answer is everybody's paywalled everything, right? We can look at the evolution of Internet 1.0. Very few people paywalled back in the day, right? Content wants to be free. Paywalls were super uncool. I think the Wall Street Journal was one of the only people who did it, right? And then over time, people did and said, no, this is my content. This is my property. You can't have it. I think that cycle's playing out more quickly here. I don't know what the right answer is. I do, and I don't know. The other topic here I think is interesting, Dan, is synthetic data. Because I read an interesting article that said, we're going to run out of data to train all this stuff pretty quickly. we've already used the internet, which is our biggest information resource, to train a lot of these models already. What else is there? And the other is people are going to start erecting these walls to say, no, not on my content, you're not. Right. So what's going to happen if we don't have enough content to train these things? We're going to have the GPU power. I'm not worried about that. I'm actually worried about training data.
I know you're biased, but if the content is in the public domain and available through, for instance, the common crawl, should a provider of an LLM be able to hoover it up without attribution?
So I don't, for example, I don't know if Kelblog's in the common crawl. I do know I'm protected by a Creative Commons license that is machine readable. So any spider should be able to look at my site and know what I'm covered by. I don't actually know its impact on where it gets included or not. Because I'll just tell you, I know my license well. Mine is, you can use my stuff, you can repurpose it, but you have to cite it and you can't have commercial use. So, and by the way, I'm sure you have this with your stuff. People scrape my stuff all the time. I find sites all the time that are just scraped Kelblog posts with ads next to them. And that is exactly what I'm trying to prevent, right? No, you're like, no, I don't put advertising on Kelblog. I'm not going to let you take my content and run ads against it and make money. So it's the non-commercial provision. So I would guess that if somebody's protected by a license that has non-commercial in it, basically, if you're a research student and you want to suck it in and build a model for a PhD thesis, great. If you want to start selling people subscriptions to it, I think not great. That's what I would call commercial use. So again, not a lawyer, not an expert, have skin in the game here. Worked with media companies like MarkLogic. That was half our business, is working with media companies on these and related issues. So I have some exposure to it. And I think it's a valid concern. I don't know how it's going to shake out. I hope the content providers do better than they did last time, because there's going to be relatively little incentive to produce original content.
That's one of the problems, is the precedent set by Google, essentially just putting a foot on the throat of the publishing industry, is definitely fresh in everyone's minds, OpenAI as well as the New York Times. So I agree, like you, this will be one of the primary themes.
The New York Times complaint was pretty compelling. I love reading original sources, and I always recommend to your listeners, if you don't read original sources on lawsuits, you have to. They're fun and they're interesting. And the New York Times complaint, when you read that, oh my gosh, it's hard not to take their side.
Prediction number five, AI-driven go-to-market efficiency. This is one that's going to be near and dear to the hearts of most of our listeners. So I can say anecdotally, I meet 6 to 8 leadership teams a week from enterprises. And across the board, I'd say everyone is a healthy level of AI curious, but nobody has what I would call an AI strategy. And they're looking to figure out what's the budget, what's the use case. These are smart leaders who understand that there may be potential productivity gains on the horizon, but nobody's really ready to commit to a strategy for a combination of reasons. The safety of it, the guardrails, explainability, IP infringement, there's a lot of risk. As a vendor, now you coach a lot of vendors and you advise a lot of them. How should vendors be thinking about the best entry point into the enterprise, given just the confusion and the lack of maturity about a lot of the technology, despite the fact that there's a big market of AI curious executives?
So I think I'm going to try and answer this one backwards, believe it or not, which is, if I were a customer, I would allocate time to experiment, because I think waiting to make a strategy until things clear out is a good way to end up getting behind. So I would just admit what we don't know. Like, we don't know who the winners are going to be. We don't know if this is going to help us more in customer support or sales or finance. We just don't know. So I want everyone to take 20% of their time and play with this stuff. Or I want the head of sales ops to take a big objective to go play with every one of these sales productivity tools we can. And let's try 3 of them and almost assume we're going to get the wrong one. Right? So we're not making a strategic bet. We're just trying to understand this market, because it's changing around us super quickly. And if we think we only have 2 options, which is make a huge strategic bet on something, which I would argue is too risky, or do nothing, which perversely I would argue is too risky, those are both wrong. So I think, and we'll get back to the vendor view in a minute, but here's, I think the customer view, I'll start with the customers, should be experiment. And normally in Silicon Valley, we say, beware customers wanting to experiment, right? That's kind of crossing the chasm. You get head faked by experimental customers and you think you have a business, and then you find out, no, darn, no, you didn't. You're in the chasm, right? So there's nothing wrong with experimental customers as long as you understand they're experimenting, right? The problem is not that they're experimenting. The problem is that you get head faked. So I think customers should be experimenting. I think the best way to make a strategy is try a bunch of these tools, see what works for you. And therefore, I think vendors should be used to people who want to experiment. Make it easy to get in, make it easy to try, make it easy to prove your value. And once you're in, try and obviously stick with them. But the other thing I tell customers is, that probably the stickiest thing from this entire predictions post, Dan, is this slide I put in from Battery. If there's one thing that caught people's attention, Battery has a slide in one of their great decks that basically says, we think you can drive the same quota with AI with 75-person sales organization that you used to need 110 people for. I.e., we think we can cut your sales org by 30% total headcount and drive the same quota. And let me tell you, be ready. If you're a CRO, be ready for the board meeting when they ask you that question, because they are going to, right? So I'm back to the customer side of this, but if I were a vendor, I'd be leading with this. Are you ready for the board meeting where your board says, how are we going to save 30% in our customer success team or our customer support team or our sales team? Because that day is coming. And if you are flat-footed when that day comes, it's bad. If you say, you know what, we've been trying 3 different systems and we agree, or we think it's more like 15 based upon what we've used right now, all far better answers than we're not sure, AI is unproven and blah, blah, blah. So I kind of answered your question backwards, but I think I got there. And the short answer is, the board's going to be asking probably in the second half of this year, what are we doing to get 20, 30% increases using AI?
I know how Frank Slootman went answer the question about cutting CS by 30%.
I can cut it by 100. I'll raise you one.
Not much of a cliffhanger there. Dave, As always, when we hang out, we're going way over time. Well worth it. Before you're getting off the hot seat this year, got to ask you one last important question. For those who are new to these conversations between Dave and I, you'll know that the only thing that Dave is more familiar with than SaaS metrics is classic rock. And you and I both enjoyed the final concert in the final tour of the Dead & Company. It was amazing at Oracle. So here's my question for you. So if you could exhume the dead bodies of two rock legends, two of your heroes, and put them on stage together for one last concert, and you and I are there together, enjoying every minute, who's on stage?
Well, I'm a big Grateful Dead fan, as you know, so Jerry Garcia, that's the easy one to answer. I don't know, I'd probably do Jerry Garcia and Jimi Hendrix, or I might do Duane Allman, so it would be one of those. By the way, rumors of a Sphere appearance for Dead & Company is coming. And by the way, if anyone of the podcast likes the Dead, the Althea from the last night of that show is simply absolutely magical. I watch it, like, when I watch it, like, 5 times in a row. It's just unbelievable to see John Mayer doing what he's doing on that song.
Thank you to YouTube. That will be immortalized. And I had a feeling you'd say Hendrix. And
yeah.
I knew you'd go with Jerry Garcia. That was a no-brainer. Wow. I'll attend that concert. Back to a theme we've been discussing, the synthetic immortal versions of Jimi Hendrix and Jerry Garcia aren't too far away. So maybe we will get to attend that concert in the metaverse, huh?
Yeah, it's possible.
All right, Dave, my man, great hanging out as always. Great job with the post. The audience is going to have to wait a year to hear how you did. But that's a wrap for this week on AI and the Future of Work. I'm your host, Dan Turchin from PeopleRain. And of course, we're back next week with another fascinating guest.